The most popular course at Harvard this past semester teaches happiness, positive psychology. It is a class that has enrolled 855 students, and it beats out even introductory economics. The students meet at 11:30, or they did meet on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and they look at serious issues here as well. They really do delve into a lot of psychological texts, but it's an indication perhaps of our time that this has become such a popular class. In the last several years, positive psychology classes have cropped up on more than 100 campuses all around the country, and we're going to be speaking with the gentleman who teaches the course at Harvard and does lecturing on happiness really all over the world. 100 classes are being taught, as I said, and also there are courses cropping up in Europe and in Asia. And we're speaking this hour about happiness, how it can not only be learned, it can be earned. And our guest is Professor Tal Ben-Shahar. He is the author of Happier, Learn the Secrets to Daily Joy and Lasting Fulfillment. Professor Ben-Shahar is one of Harvard University's most popular lecturers. He graduated from Harvard with a degree in philosophy and psychology, and for the past 10 years has been teaching personal and organizational excellence, leadership, ethics, and self-esteem. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050 for you to join our conversation. And Tal Ben-Shahar, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
So why is it that this class you teach is the most popular course at Harvard?
Well, I think everybody or most people want to be happier.
I think you're right.
This is not something peculiar necessarily to today's world, to now, but I think this has been so throughout history.
But some of it may be peculiar to today's world. You do cite levels of depression among young people, anxiety among young people. They are more anxious than they used to be, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. And this is probably because in today's world, students as well as adults are looking for happiness in the wrong places. And this manifests itself in a few ways. So first, they're looking for it in prestige or material wealth, and they're not finding it. And very often, once they get to that prestigious place, or once they make more money and they realize that they're not happier for it, they become perplexed, disappointed. They're looking for answers elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is also that our culture, in our culture, we're much busier than previous generations in our generation.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is we try and fit in more and more things into less and less time, and there is a cost to that.
Mm-hmm. You talk about, I can't remember the person's name, but you outline, and I kept thinking of all the people who are on this track starting very young in life. So you're taking the lessons that will make you a great athlete and make you top in your preschool class at age three, and then all the pressure to do the right sports, et cetera, to get into the right schools. You get into the right school, you get the right grades, you get into the best profession, be it law or whatever, and then all of a sudden you got the house, you got the cars, you got this life that's, what is it? It's a rat race.
Yeah, it's exactly a rat race, and it's so common, and it's so common because this is what in many ways our system of education rewards. It is what the workplace rewards. It rewards destinations. It doesn't reward process. It doesn't reward the journey.
Mm-hmm.
And if we think about it, most of life is the journey. So even if we get to the place that we wanted to get to, our happiness is just short-lived. It's ephemeral.
Mm-hmm.
We experience it for maybe a week or 2 weeks or a month after we get a raise or after we get a good grade or after we get into a good school.
Mm-hmm.
But then very quickly this feeling goes away and we go back to the journey. And unless we're able to make the most of the journey to derive satisfaction, pleasure, enjoyment from the day to day, we're unlikely to sustain happiness.
Yeah. You write about your experience with squash and how you devoted so many years to becoming a champion, and you became a champion and you were just ecstatic for about a day.
That's right, yeah. You know, for many years I played professional squash, and I always thought that once I won the specific title, then I would be happy. And I won it. I won the Israeli National Championships. And as you said, I was happy for about a day. And that really triggered a red light, because initially I thought, okay, so the next goal, the next objective. But then I realized that I was living my life that way, and the next objective would not be any better than the previous one. As same happened in college. You know, I wanted to get into a top college, wanted to do well in school, got into a good school, did well, and was unhappy. And it was actually then that I personally started to study psychology. Until that point, I was a computer scientist.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and I really didn't find the answers, because it didn't make sense to me. I thought if I did well, you know, the equation was do well, be happy. Succeed, be happy. It just didn't work that way.
So what is your definition? Do we all have a common definition of happiness, and by what definition do you function?
Yeah, well, we don't really have a common definition. Happiness, in many ways, it's like beauty. We know it when we see it or when we experience it. But the definition that I found most useful is the one that happiness is the experience of both meaning and pleasure. Meaningful life without the pleasure is not a happy life. A pleasurable life without the meaning isn't happy either. So our goal, our objective, if it is to be happier, should be to find activities that provide us meaning. In other words, that they're significant for us, provide us a sense of purpose, as well as that are enjoyable for us.
And you've read a lot of the great philosophers on the subject of happiness. What you just said, does that ring true with Aristotle, with Freud, with people who have thought about this?
Yeah, to a great extent, yes. I mean, in many ways, you can divide the academic literature on happiness, whether it's by philosophers or psychologists, into two camps. The one camp would be the meaning, significant, you know, the deep camp, so to speak. Okay, we have to find meaning in our lives. We have to find a sense of purpose. Then there was the other camp, which was the hedonistic camp, which was let's enjoy the day-to-day. Let's derive pleasure from what we do. And what more and more psychologists have been doing over the past few years is bridging the two, understanding that happiness isn't just the meaning deep part. It's not just the more perhaps superficial, perfunctory pleasure part. It has to be a combination of the two as much as possible.
And what about the idea that you have to live through terribly tough times, and that sometimes great tragedy or setbacks in life can open you to happiness, that they're a prerequisite for happiness in some areas?
Yes, you know, one of the, I think, reasons why there is so much depression in our culture is a phenomenon that I call the underprivilege of privilege. And what that is that when people have a life which is too easy, when things are catered for, when they're taken care of and not really allowed or given the privilege of challenge, then they're underprivileged. They pay a price for it, because when difficulties do arise, and they inevitably arise in every life, then those people don't really have the tools to deal with them. And then there is another element, that our ability to deal with difficulties, our abilities to go through tough experiences, actually enhances our capacity for happiness. And one of the things that I talk about in class is the notion that we need to learn to fail, or else we'll fail to learn. And this is true for everything from learning how to walk. We first have to fall down before we know how to walk. It applies to learning how to play the violin. It also applies to learning how to derive the most out of our lives.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We want to tell our audience, tell Ben Shahar is our guest, and his book is Happier, Learn the Secrets to Daily Joy and Lasting Fulfillment. He teaches this course that is the most popular course at Harvard, and it's a course on positive psychology. 855 students last semester, and I think it's an indication of our times in some way. And so it's not a fluff course. They really look at thoughts on happiness from great philosophers and psychologists and psychiatrists, and it's also filled with some exercises, which I think are quite valuable. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050 for you to join our conversation and answer the question, do you think that you can learn to be happy? Have you learned to be happy? What does happiness mean to you? How do you find happiness? How do you hold on to happiness? What's the parallel between great trials and tribulations and achieving happiness? We certainly welcome your phone calls on this, and yeah, it's a good thing for us to talk about for a full hour, I think. Happiness. 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest is the author of Happier, Tal Ben-Shahar. Professor Ben-Shahar is one of Harvard University's most popular lecturers. He has been teaching lots of students. His course on positive psychology classes attract 1,400 students per semester, about 20% of all Harvard graduates. He graduated from Harvard with a degree in philosophy and psychology, and for the past 10 years has been teaching personal and organizational excellence, leadership, ethics, and self-esteem. 800-486-8655, David from Manitowoc. Hi, David.
Good evening, or good morning. How are you doing today?
Fine. How are you, David?
I'm doing great.
Good.
I came back from a kayaking trip.
Ooh, I love kayaking. I love it. It's one of my favorite things in the whole world.
It was spectacular.
Oh, great. Go right ahead, David.
My question for Dr. Shahar is, if it's not material, which I would agree with him on that, it's got to be spiritual. And if it's spiritual, that gives us our, does that not give us our goal in life or our purpose in life? For example, as a Christian man, my goal in life is to lead that Christian life so that I can lead others to the Lord. And isn't that something that would make us happy because it gives us purpose?
Yeah, it's a great question, David. And you're right on in terms of spirituality. You know, we weren't made to lead just a material life. We need the spiritual in our life. The question then becomes, what is spiritual for us? And what is spiritual for me is different from what is spiritual for you, possibly. If you look at the meaning of the word spirituality, it is, one of the meanings is a sense of significance, a sense of importance. And this is the question that we need to ask ourselves. So what is important for me in my life? Is it God? Is it family? Is it my work? Is it all of the above? And when we identify the significant thing in our life and pursue it, that is when we experience spirituality, that is when we experience happiness. Now, the fact that it's different for everyone means that, for example, a person who is an investment banker, because she truly loves what she does, she really thinks it is important, may be more spiritual than a monk who goes into his business for the wrong reasons. In other words, the element of significance defines spirituality.
And what you're saying, and I agree, that the reason why I brought up the Christian thing is because some spiritual things, it's what we do, but from a Christian's perspective, it's what the Lord has done for us. And that way, you don't have to work for anything. The Lord's given it to you, but you then, out of your love for the Lord and what he's done for you, you live that life, and that does make you happy to some extent. Don't get me wrong. There's going to be lows and highs. I mean,
yep.
I just got through a goal of mine. And through that goal, there were positive and negative. And that's the daily, that's the day-to-day.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, the spiritual life of a Christian is going to be happy because you realize what the Lord's done for you. And so that would fit into your philosophy to a point. I'm just more specific with a Christian's philosophy, I guess, then, right?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, in fact, there's a lot of research out there by psychologists showing that people who have a religious faith are generally happier. And the question that psychologists have asked is, you know, what is it about religion that makes people happier? One of the reasons is a sense of spirituality. Another one that you just alluded to is that in religion, we don't take our lives for granted. We don't take the, whether it's the food on our table, whether it's our family, whether it's our work, we don't take these things for granted. We express gratitude on a regular basis. And expressing gratitude opens us up to much more joy and enjoyment in life.
Yeah. One of your exercises, which you, my son and I did last night, which we're going to keep doing for, I mean, it sounds like a simple thing, but to write it down and then to say to each other the things that you were grateful for in a day. And there are so many of them, right? And then you start thinking more about what you are grateful for when you've thought about what you had that you're grateful for the day before.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, this has actually been studied. I mean, it's a very simple exercise. It was studied by Professor Robert Emmons from UC Davis. And he asked people every night before going to sleep to write down at least five things for which they were grateful. You know, big things like family, little thing like a nice meal that I had.
Mm-hmm.
And to write them down with meaning, and if possible, to share them with others. People who wrote these things down were happier, more optimistic. Interestingly, their immune system got stronger, so they became healthier.
Huh.
They also became more generous as well as more successful. And if you think about this, this takes 3-4 minutes each evening.
Mm-hmm.
With real significant changes.
Yeah, you know, it's a very good thing to do. We're going to do it again tonight, thanks
That's
to you.
Great.
So so thank you. Let's go to Tina next from Madison. Hi, Tina.
Hi.
Hi.
Like the last caller, I too am a Christian, and I think that this author here is kind of also talking more about contentedness. Sometimes the word happiness can imply dependent upon circumstances, and contentedness is even through the rough eras of your life, you can still find that sense of peace. I've had a lot of deaths around me recently, including my mother.
Mm.
But you get through it by finding a sense of peace. And it's because happiness, let's face it, you're just not happy about a lot of things going on in your life. But contentedness, to me, I find actually almost better.
Mm.
I mean, to split hairs and definitions of terms here.
You know, I think you hit on a very important point. It was interesting when I started to teach a class on positive psychology, a student who wasn't in the class came up to me and said, you know, I hear you're teaching a class on happiness. And I said, yes, that's right. And he said, you know, but you've got to watch out now. And I said to him, why? And he said, because if I ever see you unhappy, I'll tell the students. Assuming that, you know, I should have a constant high on that, or that is what happiness is.
Mm-hmm.
And I used that as a teaching point the next day, and I told the students, you know, the last thing I want you to think is that, you know, I experience a constant high, or that by the end of this class you'll do something similar. You know, there are two kinds of people who don't experience emotional pain, and this could be the pain of loss, sadness, disappointment, envy, or anger at times. There are two kinds of people who don't experience these painful emotions. The one kind of people are the psychopaths.
Hmm.
The second kind of people are dead people.
Hmm.
So, you know, if we do experience these emotions, it's actually a good sign. And the key is, as you mentioned, is just to give ourselves the permission to be human, to allow ourselves to experience these painful emotions at times. Because when we don't give ourselves the permission to be human, they only get stronger. When we do give ourselves the permission to be human, we're much more likely to feel this contentedness. We're much more likely to feel this calm, this sense of acceptance. And this is one of the pillars of a happy and fulfilling life. Not a constant high, but this sense that it's okay. You know, even if things are difficult, it's part of nature. There are ups and downs. We all experience them. And this sense of acceptance opens us up also to more positive emotions.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. What's the? You have a chapter and also some exercises on rituals. What's this connection between ritual and happiness?
Yeah, this is very important. I first learned about it from in a book called The Power of Full Engagement, where they talk about us having to shift our perspective from self-discipline to ritual. So what does this mean? You see, we've all got a very limited amount of self-discipline. How do I know that? I mean, just look at New Year's resolutions.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them fail.
Right.
Mine fail, and I think most people fail. However, if we're able to introduce rituals to our lives, we're much more likely to succeed in maintaining a change. So, for example, you know, most people, just about all people, get up in the morning, brush their teeth. It doesn't take any special powers of discipline to do that. Why? Because it's a ritual. You know, many athletes, when exercising, they don't need special discipline for it because it is a ritual. Mm-hmm. They do it regularly. Now, the challenge is to create rituals in our lives, rituals that would make a positive change. So, for example, I have a ritual that my wife and I go on a date once a week in the evening, and then we have an afternoon which we spend together. It's a ritual.
Hmm.
Now, if it wasn't a ritual, in our modern world, it is very difficult to find time for things outside work or outside the things that are absolutely necessary. But once we create a ritual, we do it regularly. There are not even questions about it.
Hmm.
It just gets done.
Mm-hmm.
Now, many people may say, well, what about spontaneity? And yeah, you know, it would be nice to be spontaneous about all things. But again, in our modern world, with the fast pace, with the rat race, if we don't ritualize it, very often,
yes,
usually it doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
The key is also to do the same for physical exercise. Ritualize 3 times a week of physical exercise contributes significantly to our well-being. Once the ritual is in place, once it becomes a habit, we no longer need self-discipline
mm-hmm.
to follow up on it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Vince from Dodgeville. Hi, Vince.
Hello. The Dalai Lama has written quite a bit about happiness, and he ties it to compassion.
Mm.
And the more that a person can develop empathy for the suffering and joy of others, the more compassion they can develop, the more they can overcome their own afflictive feelings, negative feelings, and get outside of themselves. Because I think he thinks that a lot of unhappiness comes from narcissism, kind of being locked into yourself and your self-preoccupation. And compassion is the key to escaping from narcissism.
Hmm.
I wondered if our author, if there's any evidence to support that theory, that compassion helps to lead one to a happier life.
Yeah, there is a lot. And see, the Dalai Lama has a fascinating discussion about compassion. The word in Tibetan is tsewe. What tsewe means is compassion both for others and for self. In fact, there is a report about when the Dalai Lama first heard about our use of the word compassion, and he was very surprised that it precludes the self. That when we talk about compassion, we usually mean compassion toward others only. What the Dalai Lama is saying is that if we have compassion for ourselves as well as for others, and we create sort of a self-reinforcing loop among the two, that's when our levels of happiness increase. Now, there is a lot of research, and we don't need even research for this. This is common sense, that when we help others, when we express empathy toward others, not only are we helping them, we're also helping ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just think about the last time when you felt like you did a good deed for someone else. And the key is to understand that the two are intertwined. You know, we are linked together in a web of empathy. Helping others is helping ourselves. There's also a lot of research that shows that when we help ourselves, when we do good things for ourselves, we become more generous, more benevolent, and more helpful toward others. And as the Dalai Lama pointed out, the key is to create this self-reinforcing loop, in a sense, and reaching for higher levels of compassion, higher levels of well-being for ourselves, reaching for higher levels of compassion, well-being for others, and these two reinforcing one another.
Mm-hmm.
Two sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm.
How does this fit into his idea that compassion helps to overcome afflictive emotions, the negative emotions like anger and envy and hate and greed that we kind of torture ourselves with, create our own hell.
Yeah, very, very good. Yeah, so in fact, what has been shown, you know, interestingly, a lot of the ideas from Buddhism that have been around for 2,500 years or more, research is now coming out to show how true they are, and this is one of them. We can't have two contradictory emotions. We can't hold two contradictory emotions at the same time. So you can at the same time hate and then feel compassion and love.
Hmm.
In other words, if we fill our mind and heart with compassion, with loving kindness, then it is much more likely to, in a way, to dispel, to throw out the afflictive emotions. So yes, the more we can experience positive emotions, the less we'll have the painful emotions, the afflictive ones.
Mm-hmm.
Mm, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Vince, so much for your call. Thinking of the Dalai Lama, some of the words that come immediately to mind are meditation, and I know that you write about meditation in your book as well. Why? What's its connection to happiness?
Well, the interesting thing about the Dalai Lama is that about 6 years ago, he came out with the following statement saying, I would like to subject all the tenets of Buddhism to the test of science. And if anything doesn't work, if science disproves these tenets, we'll just get rid of them. One of the things that were tested was meditation. And the results were quite literally mind-boggling.
Hmm.
So, for example, and this was shown also not just on professional meditators, but people who meditate just on a regular basis, but for 20 minutes to 1 hour a day. People who meditate regularly show an actual change in their brain, meaning we know from doing PET scans or fMRIs or EEGs, we know that if the left side of our prefrontal cortex, that the front side on the left, has more activation than on the left side than on the right side, then we know that we're more susceptible to positive emotions and more resilient in the face of painful emotions.
Mm.
And what meditation does is people who meditate for as little as 8 weeks, 45 minutes a day, you can see a significant change in their brain activation. Their left side becomes more active, their right side becomes less active. In other words, their mood increases, improves. Now, we know that from their self-report, how they describe their lives, but we also know it from much more objective means, such as scanning their brain. Their brain actually changes. Now, this was a very surprising finding because until 1998, most psychologists and neuroscientists thought that the brain doesn't change after the age of 3. Now we know that it does, and one of the ways to change it and make it more more positive, in a sense, is through meditation, which could be yoga, it could be sitting meditation,
mm-hmm.
or various other forms of mindfulness training.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Let's go next to Dennis from Milwaukee. Hi, Dennis.
Hi.
Hi.
I think there's one major component that's not being plugged into this. And Michael Parenti has a speech on human nature and politics that you can download on the internet. And what it boils down to is class, gender, and race exploiting land, labor, and natural resources. And this has been going on for centuries. The history of feudalism, capitalism, colonialism, imperialism. And I think common people are pretty good in human nature. I mean, nature is an abstract anyways, but I think it's the rich people that need to learn how to help, how to share, and how to respect others. But they've been always dividing us, antagonizing collective betterment. Sort of like the last show that you just had on was an example of how Saddam and the U.S. antagonized the Iraqi labor movement. And science and religion can be used to do this as well.
All right, I'm just trying to work this. I'm with you what you're saying, but I'm trying to work it to a discussion of being happy.
So maybe I can address.
All right, thank you. Yes.
Some of the ideas. So you bring up many ideas. Let me just address a couple where that I can talk about because there is actually research on them. So if you look at collective well-being, so they looked at different cultures in different places, there is very little difference among them in terms of level of happiness. What does make a difference? Free societies are happier than oppressive societies. So, for example, in U.S. or Western Europe, levels of happiness have been significantly higher than under the communist regime, where there was far less freedom. Also, places where women are oppressed, there is certainly far less happiness for women. So the external matters to that extent. Are you free or are you under oppression? Beyond that, there is very little difference among cultures, not in terms of cultures that are wealthier than others. So if there is a country, say, that lives on the brink of poverty and people are very poor, yes, it does matter to levels of happiness. But once basic needs are met, and by basic needs, I mean food, shelter, basic education. Beyond that, there is very little difference between the happiness of the rich and the happiness of the others who are not so rich,
mm-hmm.
once the basic needs are met.
I think he was in, and it put me in a strange frame of mind as we entered this interview, because we had the last hour of our program to labor leaders from Iraq, and one of whom went through horrendous times under Saddam and is going through horrendous times now, and a woman who is a head of a labor union who's, you know, virtually living in her house with her son and has had death threats. And, and you know, they kind of I was so aware of what they're – no, I'm not completely aware, but I had a sense of what they are living under and how incredibly different their lives are than my life. And
yeah.
And I wonder, you know, can you even think about happiness if you're living in under, you know, death threats and people are being blown up in front of your house every day? And I'm wondering about even a possibility for happiness in parts of the world where this is their reality.
Yeah. So the simple answer would be no. I mean, they're really it's very hard. It's very hard not having our very basic needs met, which is a need for security,
yes.
a need for being able to get out of the house and
yeah.
go to the store or go to school. So that is the, you know, the short answer would be no. However, what we do see are people who, in such situations, who are still able to find a little bit of happiness, you know, such as, you know, getting closer with their families or appreciating what they do have. And learning to appreciate what they do have very often makes a significant difference in their lives. But, you know, saying that these people will reach happiness, you know, under oppressive regimes or situations, you know, would be a real stretch.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, they can find a little bit more happiness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's take a less extreme example. You know, in our culture, there are people who have to work extremely hard just to get, you know, their daily bread.
Right.
Now, can I go to such a person and say, well, if you want to be happy, you need to find both meaning and pleasure in your life.
Right.
I mean, that person has to go to work. You know, think of a single mom,
mm-hmm.
or who has to do that. So what can she do? One of the things that she can do is say, all right, I have a rough life. I have to get the bread on the table. Can I find maybe an hour or 2 hours during the week when I do things that are both meaningful and pleasurable to me, such as spending time with my kids,
mm-hmm.
or such as taking up a hobby that I've always wanted to take up? And very often, 1 or 2 hours during the week of doing things that are meaningful or
mm-hmm.
pleasurable, they have a trickle effect for the rest of the week. Why? Because we look forward to those, so they give us a motivational pull. And after that, after we do them, they also give us the motivational push in that we feel better. So it's not an all or nothing proposition. Even 1 or 2 hours of meaning and pleasure during the week can make a big difference, can make us happier.
Mm-hmm. And what about my obligation to have compassion and try to help those people who have limited avenues to happiness? That, in other words, I can't truly be happy unless all people have that avenue open.
Well, as I said earlier, it is certainly the case that the more we help others, the more we help ourselves.
Right.
And the more compassion we practice toward others, the more helpful it is to our well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to see them as two sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, what I'm talking about here is not the negation of the self. It's not to say, well, I cannot be happy until others are happy. On the contrary, what I'm saying is that, and this is something, by the way, the Buddha said many years ago, is that the more we contribute to others' happiness, the happier we become. The happier we become, the more likely we are to contribute to other people's happiness.
Hmm. More phone calls in a moment. We're speaking with the author of Happier, Learn the Secrets to Daily Joy and Lasting Fulfillment. Tal Ben-Shahar is our guest, and he teaches, well, he's one of Harvard University's most popular lecturers. His class is attracting thousands of students per semester, 20% of all Harvard graduates. And this is catching on, this happiness class, is positive psychology in universities all over the United States and also in Europe and in Asia. So this book is based on what he teaches in the classroom, and we're welcoming phone calls for him at 800-486-8655. Tal Ben-Shahar has been teaching personal and organizational excellence, leadership, ethics, and self-esteem for the past 10 years. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Thanks, Dennis, for the call. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go back to phone calls now to Ken next from Albany. Hi, Ken.
Hello. With all the kids going to the class, it seems like they missed something in their upbringing. Do you have anything as far as what we want for our children and how to accomplish that concerning what you're saying?
Yeah, you know, there is more and more work now being done on positive psychology, starting it earlier on. So starting it from as young as kindergarten age. And of course, parenting is critical for starting it early. And the first thing that parents can do for kids is become role models. You know, children do what parents do rather than what they say. So the question is, how can I role model a happy life? Or I would use a different word even, an authentic life.
Mm.
Because a happy life, again, is not a life of a constant high. How can I model that for my students? And one of the things, both to model as well as to discuss, is what are the most important things in my in a life? What is, as I talk about in the book, the ultimate currency? In our culture today, in our world today, the ultimate currency is mostly success, prestige, wealth. We need to change that, and we need children to understand that the ultimate currency in life is happiness, whether it's individual happiness as well as collective happiness. Again, it was instituted in our Declaration of Independence, the pursuit of happiness as a self-evident truth. So can we model it for our kids? Can we promote their happiness? And in practice, what that means is rewarding those parts of life. So not just rewarding when they get a good grade in school, not just rewarding when they get into a sports team or become the president of a club, but rewarding their ability to learn, rewarding also their willingness to try, even their willingness to fail. And that's when we're rewarding the journey, not just the destination.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's a key element. And kids can tell the difference. I mean, they know what parents value. And very often, these values are internalized. So do we truly value the process, or do we just value the outcome? And if in words and deeds we communicate to the kids that we value the process, the journey, the day-to-day, then they're much more likely to become happier, appreciate their lives, and then communicate this onward to their friends as well as to their children. That's one thing. The other thing that I would like to touch upon is, in many ways, we need to think of training when we're talking about kids or students or employees or ourselves. We want to create life connoisseurs. How do we create life connoisseurs? Well, think of the analogy. How do we become wine connoisseurs? It's not by drinking the glass of wine all at the same time and drinking more and more. It's by sipping. It's by savoring. It's by enjoying. Similarly, we need to do for our kids. We need to simplify their lives to the point where they regain the enjoyment, the pleasure that they had as when they were very young, or when we were very young, to take their time, not to overload them, not to encourage them to do, you know, 20 things after school, but to limit their activity so that they have more time. And that doesn't mean more time in front of the TV.
Mm-hmm.
It means more time deriving pleasure, enjoyment, and meaning from a meal with a family, from a nice story, from spending time with their friends.
Mm-hmm. We need more time, don't we? We need more time.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
Or we need to do less in the time that we have.
Yes. Thanks, Ken, so much for your call. Let's go next to Dan from Stevens Point. Hi, Dan.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I recently, about 2 days ago, had to take a rather long car trip, an hour and a half, with my father, who has Alzheimer's.
Uh-huh.
I had to take him to a doctor for an examination. And we, on the car trip, my father, who is almost 90, spent most of the trip talking about how beautiful it was outside and how fortunate we are to live in such a beautiful state as Wisconsin, and how gorgeous the scenery is and how wonderful things are. And it just struck me how happy he is in his condition. A lot of people feel very sorry, justifiably so, for people with Alzheimer's, but they themselves seem to have found a great deal of happiness and acceptance and appreciation for what's going on at the moment. It reminds me a little bit of children who seem to have that same quality.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. It's a lovely story, and you know, I hope you repeat it, you know, to your loved ones, because it captures so much wisdom in it. There's been done research, and again, we all know it from experience, on terminally ill patients. You know, people. This was specific. This the research I'm thinking of now was with terminal cancer. And many of the people who were going through the disease said that for the first time in their lives, they're feeling fully alive.
Hmm.
Why? Because for the first time, they're really appreciating the precious, the little things in life, such as the ability to breathe, such as their family, such as a nice meal, not taking them for granted. You see, the treasures of happiness are all around us. If we look right now where we are, there are treasures of happiness. It's in the air that we breathe. It's in a flower that we perhaps can see. It's in the picture of our family. I mean, the treasures of happiness are all around us. And the challenge for us is to learn to appreciate them. And the question is, do we need to wait for a tragedy or for something painful and difficult to happen in order to appreciate what we already have?
Mm-hmm.
Or can we learn to appreciate it right now? And the exercise that I mentioned earlier about keeping a gratitude journal and sharing that journal with people about whom we care, this in and of itself can prevent us from taking our life for granted,
mm-hmm.
and mine the treasures of happiness that are right here, right now.
Thank you, Dan. Unless you had something else.
No, thank you.
No, thank you. Thanks
thank
for
you.
Your call. Sean is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Sean.
Hi, good afternoon, or good morning, I'm sorry.
I wanted
to talk a little bit about, you know, happiness as it relates to some of our jobs. I'm a physician in training here in Milwaukee, and to make that transition from medical school to actually delivering, you know, care to people was not quite the transition I expected. And it took quite some time to find it within me to some pleasure in that pursuit. Medicine as it's delivered, of course, in the United States, I'm sure you've discussed this in other programs, is not, it's getting less and less satisfying for a lot of physicians, and yet most of the mature ones I've met have kept a part of themselves alive and open to taking pleasure in helping people, despite the cynicism that's kind of rampant in our profession. Somehow being open to that is probably the most valuable lesson I've learned through my training, and I'm grateful just for that it hasn't killed me off yet.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's a great example. You know, the field of medicine, when you have to see so many patients every day, you really don't have much time to, you know, what we spoke about earlier, to savor, to enjoy, to derive pleasure, to understand why you went to medical school in the first place. And the key is then to create, you know, an oasis or islands during the day where you do take a minute or two to reflect. And again, as a doctor, you know about the fight or flight response versus the relaxation response. So when we run fast, when we're always in the rat race chasing, whether it's as doctors, whether it's as drivers, and whether it's as teachers, when we're running, we're in a fight-or-flight response. We're anxious. We're not breathing deeply. We certainly don't have time to appreciate the scenery.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can create a few minutes during the day of just sitting down and breathing deeply, you know, taking a few deep breaths, and while breathing, thinking about the things that we appreciate, thinking about calm, perhaps about a place that helps to helps us relax, just a few breaths, a minute or 2 minutes, very often it energizes us. It makes us reappreciate. It makes us remember what we're actually doing, as opposed to taking it for granted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you're so right. You know, we by the time you get to finishing medical school, most of us have probably invested anywhere between, you know, 8 and 10 years of higher education. And in that, you know, competitive spirit of always trying to do well, it's so easy to lose track of why you decided to become a doctor in the first place. And unfortunately, you know, the reality of practicing medicine is nowhere near the popular mythos that exists in our culture. And to somehow maybe realign or redefine what your expectations of your own job and your own career are, I think that's key for anybody, not just in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
I know that the reality of whatever our childhood dreams are is probably not the actual reality of what it is. And yet we still have to find a way to go forward and take some pleasure in that, to do right by ourselves, by our families, and by our patients.
Right.
So that's really all I got to say, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Sean, so much for calling.
Sure.
Thank you. I was thinking of time as Sean was talking. He needs more time. You know, that whole profession, you need more time. You need time, and it's going in the opposite direction. You need time to be with your doctor. Your doctor needs time to be with you to really connect, and it's not happening.
Yeah, it's not happening. You know, one of the things that one of the interesting studies that came out recently, this is by Daniel Kahneman, who's a Nobel Prize winner, asked women how much they enjoy each of the activities that they go through during the day. And this applies to men as well. And what he found was the most fascinating part of that study and disturbing part of that study was that these women, or many of these women, did not particularly enjoy spending time with their kids.
Oh, my.
And the reason was not because, it's not that they didn't love their kids, of course they did, and they found it very meaningful. But the reason why they didn't particularly enjoy it was because when they were with their kids, they were not really with their kids, meaning they were on the phone at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing email at the same time. They were thinking about what they did or what they had to do later, and they weren't present. So what is the solution to this? The solution is to simplify. You know, whether it's things like switching off the phone when we're doing things that are important for us, whether it's not being connected to the email all the time when we're at work or when we're at home, it's simplifying our lives. It applies to being a doctor. You know, how can I switch myself off and just focus on that patient? Afterwards, I can do the 100 other things that I need to do. But as I said earlier, how can we create islands of presence during the day? Islands that will remind ourselves why we were there in the first place, why that was a worthy profession or career or a calling early on in life. And by the way, the same applies to relationships. Within relationships, the most successful relationships are ones in which the two partners never stop to remind themselves why they're together, of the virtues of one another and of the virtues of their collective family that they have created.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the call, Sean. Let's go to Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good morning. Well, this is a phenomenal program. I'm so grateful for it. Yeah, I just have one observation. A couple years ago, I came to a point where I realized that I was raised in the middle class, and all around me and where I was living at the time a number of years ago was people, everybody was just chasing the American dream, which was basically, honestly, was materialism.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a part of that, and I just decided that I was losing my children, and they were seeing this. As you talked about children, they were seeing what I really valued, and what I was talking was a different talk than what I was walking. And I moved my family down here to Texas, and to simplify things, I pulled my kids out of public school, and I got them in a character education program, and I realigned the values of my life, and I found one thing, and that I'm a lot happier, my relationship with my kids is stronger, And I have time for things that are really valuable. And I feel so much less stress in my life, so much closer to my children, to my family, and to God. And I think that and I see all around me people whose lives are simple, immigrants who have very little, who are very happy. Their families are close. And I see people, I have my own business, who are very wealthy, who've chased the American dream and who've come to the end of their life and they've lost their kids, they're divorced, and they're miserable. And I see it's so sad that in chasing the American dream, we're losing everything of value. And it's destroying our culture.
Yep. Thank you, Steve, very much for the call. And then we'll say goodbye. Tal Ben-Shahar, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
The book is Happier, Learn the Secrets to Daily Joy and Lasting Fulfillment. He teaches Harvard University's most popular course on positive psychology, and he is a graduate of Harvard with a degree in philosophy and psychology and has been teaching personal and organizational excellence, leadership, ethics, and self-esteem for the past 10 years. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and to Jerome Owens for on-air production here in our studios. And thank you, everybody, for all of your calls. All Things Political, Monday at 9. We do that on Mondays. And then we're going to start looking at college education, second hour of our show Monday. This is the Ideas Network.